Daniel. So, we're going to read Daniel chapter 1, the whole of the chapter. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord delivered Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, along with some of the articles from the temple of God. These he carried off to the temple of his God in Babylonia to put in the treasure house of his God. Then the king ordered Ashpenaz, chief of his court officials, to bring into the king's service some of the Israelites from the royal family and the nobility, young men without any physical defect, handsome, showing aptitude for every kind of learning, well-informed, quick to understand, and qualified to serve in the king's palace. He was to teach them the language and literature of the Babylonians. The king assigned them a daily amount of food and wine from the king's table. They were to be trained for 3 years, and after that, they were to enter the king's service. Among those who were chosen were some from Judah: Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. The chief official gave them new names: to Daniel, the name Belteshazzar; to Hananiah, Shadrach; to Mishael, Meshach; and to Azariah, Abednego. But Daniel resolved not to defile himself with the royal food and wine, and he asked the chief official for permission not to defile himself in this way. Now God had called the official to show favour and compassion to Daniel, but the official told Daniel, "I'm afraid of my lord the king, who has assigned you food and drink. Why should he see you looking worse than the other young men of your age? The king would then have my head because of you." Daniel then said to the God, whom the chief official had appointed over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, "Please test your servants for 10 days. Give us nothing but vegetables to eat and water to drink. Then, compare our appearance with that of the young men who eat the royal food, and treat your servants in accordance with what you see." So he agreed to this and tested them for 10 days. At the end of the 10 days, they looked healthier and better nourished than any of the young men who ate the royal food. So the God took away their choice food and wine, and the wine they were to drink, and gave them vegetables instead. To these 4 young men, God gave knowledge and understanding of all kinds of literature and learning, and Daniel could understand visions and dreams of all kinds. At the end of the time set by the king to bring them into his service, the chief official presented them to Nebuchadnezzar. The king talked with them, and he found not equal to Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. So they entered the king's service. In every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king questioned them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters in his whole kingdom. And Daniel remained there until the first year of King Cyrus. So, there might be, it seems, a tension in our lives between the need to be distinctive, to be different, to be set apart from God, and to function in the world that we're in. That was the case for Daniel, and I think that's the case for us today. Sometimes the world is even hostile to us and to our faith, but we have to function in it whilst being distinctive. Not long before he died, Jesus prayed for his disciples, and he said this. So he's praying to God the Father. He says, "I have given them your word, and the world has hated them, for they are not of the world any more than I am of the world. My prayer is not that you take them out of the world, but that you protect them from the evil one. They are not of the world, even as I am not of it." Jesus realises, he knew, that for the disciples and for us now, that we aren't belonging to the world, but we're in it. And we have to be in it, but we need to make sure we don't become of it. And throughout the Bible, we see many stories of people who live their lives for God whilst functioning in what we might call the secular world. Now, I hate the word secular. And it's interesting about where it came from, because actually, it used to mean a period of time. So seculum was a Latin word for a set period of time. And then eventually it came to mean 100 years, because in the Roman Empire, that was the very, very best you could expect to live, would be 100 years. So it came to mean a lifespan. And it was Augustine who started to use it to refer to things different to things that were religious, which is where we get the distinction secular and religious from. So secular is about human life on earth, and then religious, if you like, which is another word I don't like. Religious studies teach me anyway. Religious is another word I don't like. But that's the contrast. So secular is your life on earth. The religious life is that bit that goes on beyond, because obviously there's something in life that goes on beyond life. That's the religious part. So when I use the word secular, you hopefully understand what I mean, even though it's a horrible word. Anyway, that's a word fact for you. Now, Joseph's a really good example of somebody who did this. There's lots of lessons we can learn from Joseph, but of course we know that he was working for Potiphar and then working for Pharaoh in an ungodly situation, but he had a huge impact on the world around him. And Daniel is, I think, another really good example. So we're going to look at, obviously I want to have read Daniel and then talk about Joseph, but we're going to look at Daniel today and see how he managed to strike this balance between being in the world but not becoming of the world. So a little bit of context. The people of Judah had been warned many times by God that they needed to sort themselves out, and they hadn't. And so they were exiled to Babylon. Jerusalem was ransacked. But the king obviously recognised some good people in Judah. And so he asked the chief of staff to find some people of the nobility to enter his service. So the first question that struck me was, why on earth would you do that? If you were king of a great empire, which Nebuchadnezzar was, why would you pick some random people from this place you'd exiled to enter your service? There must have been something, maybe specifically in these individuals, but also more generally in Jewish culture, that he really admired. He picked these people because there was something special about them. This is more than just slave labour. I'll bring over these people to do all the hard work for me. He probably did that as well, but this is what this is about. Because he actually invested a lot into them. They were very well cared for. They were invested in. They were on a 3-year training programme, so that it could be equipped with knowledge and skills to then work for him afterwards. I am sure there were lots of people in his empire who could have done that and who did do that, as we know. But he saw something really special in these people. And so he asked his chief of staff to do the hard work and actually find the individuals. And then even before they've entered the king's service, he recognises something special about them. I mean, first of all, they're handsome. Why that's relevant, I'm not sure, but they are. They show aptitude for learning. They're well informed and they're equipped to understand. That's a glowing reference for these men, even before they've started learning in the way that the king needs them to. So it's like they've been headhunted, been picked out, because they've something in them that shows that they're up for the job. So that's maybe why they've been chosen. But what have they been chosen for? Well, verse 4 tells us that these people are going to be taught the language and literature of the Babylonians, which would, I'm sure, have included the history, myths of the empire. The Babylonians were very good at maths and science, so it probably involved that. Language, apparently, was extremely complicated. The language most people spoke was straightforward, but the language of the literature of the empire was very complex. It probably also involved some astrology. And so the training would last for 3 years. I imagine that would be quite intense and difficult, but again, the chief of staff knew they were up to the job. And the idea would be that once they'd done the 3 years, if they were good enough, they'd then go and serve the king. It's not really clear what serve the king means, but that's what they were picked to do. So then I think, well, how would you feel in this situation? I'm sure they would be devastated to be missing home. They'd been taken from where they were comfortable, and they were in this strange foreign land, so they'd have probably been missing home. They would have been quite scared, quite worried. But then when they found out they'd been picked for this special job, they might have felt a bit privileged, pleased to have been chosen, but probably quite apprehensive about what this would involve. And certainly they'd have been quite surprised. And of course, we know, having read the rest of the story, God has a very clear plan. But whether they understood that at the time, we're not sure. So then just to make it really clear that they were not the people of Judah anymore, they're all given new names. And we see in verses 6 and 7 what those names are. And I think it is interesting just to look at what the names mean. So Daniel means God is my judge, and he is renamed Belteshazzar, which means Bel, protect my life. And Bel is one of the gods of Babylon. Hananiah means Yahweh shows grace. His name becomes Shadrach, which means command of Aku. And Aku is another god of Babylon. Mishael means who is what God is. And that becomes Meshach, which means who is what Aku is. And Azariah means Yahweh helps. He becomes Abednego, which means servant of Nebo, another god of the Babylonians. So it's really clear that in choosing these names, Ashpenaz is showing that he wants to really change their identities, trying to remove their Jewish culture, replace it with that of Babylon. They clearly show who he believes is in charge. Yahweh is replaced with all these other gods. And then they arrive, and as part of their training program, they are fed. And they're not just given the scraps, but they are given food from the king's table, which, again, would seem quite a privilege. But Daniel doesn't want to eat this food. Now, it's not clear whether he's been elected spokesman of the four, or whether they were quite happy to eat it and he intervened for them. Who knows? But either way, he speaks up and he says, I'm not going to eat this food. Let me just eat vegetables and water. So why? Well, it tells us here that he doesn't want to be defiled by this food. So it probably is the case that this meat had been offered to idols, and so that would be bad for a Jewish man to eat. The wine is usually spilled before, not all of it, because I've got to drink it, but some of the wine is spilled before a pagan altar, often. The meat might have been unclean, because as you may be aware, certain animals were condemned to be eaten by God, so that might be a case. And even if the meat was clean, animals that the Jewish people could eat, they probably weren't killed in the way that Jewish customs said they should be killed. So that's probably what this means by being defiled. But commentators disagree on this. But it's probably the case that the vegetables were also offered to pagan gods. Crops would be offered to God, as with the Jewish people, they offered their crops to God as well as the meat. So it looks like there's something more to it than just the simple fact that appears to be obvious. Sorry, I've completely lost my place. More likely is that Jesus needs to take a stand. Daniel needs to take a stand somewhere, and he's picked this to be the place where he takes his stand. He could have tried to refuse to go, but that wouldn't have worked, they'd have dragged him there anyway, so there was no point in trying to fight that, perhaps. He could have said, I'm not going to enter your training program, but again, they've got him there, he's hostage, he's going to be tricky, and he might end up killed for that. He could object to the name change. Maybe he does, but he doesn't tell us that he does. That's perhaps not the best idea, because if somebody starts to call you something, you say, no, you're not calling me that, they're going to call you that anyway, aren't they? So there's no point in objecting to the name change. And obviously, I think this is important to decide, we still call him Daniel today anyway. So we realise the name change was not that important. But refusing the food, perhaps, was a simple and effective way of showing those around him that he was different. God had given him the wisdom to pick his battle, you might say. He realised that that was the area to take a stand on. And so that's what he did. He refused to eat the food. So he says this to Ashpenaz. And although Ashpenaz likes Daniel, God's caused him to show favour to Daniel, he's quite worried about the anger of the king. And so he refuses. He says, no, the king is going to kill me if we do that. I'm not happy about this situation. You've got to eat the meat. So Daniel could have said, all right, then fine, I've tried. But he doesn't. He then goes to the God. It's not very clear in the NIV. The translation's bad. But if you look at the original, it's very clear that this God is a completely different person. He's even got a name. I think it's the name of somebody. So he goes to the God behind Ashpenaz's back, I suppose, and says, test us. Test us for 10 days. Give us vegetables and water. See how we do. The God agrees. And after the 10 days, they look healthier than all the rest of the men. So the God changes this menu permanently. At what point, if ever, Ashpenaz finds out, we're not really sure. But it's certainly the case that the God who feeds them knows, and all the other people around would have known, that they weren't eating the meat, they weren't drinking the wine. So it's a good witness that they are standing out, they're being different, they've picked this to take a stand on, and they're not going to be completely absorbed by the culture. They are there, in this culture, but they're not, and they're interacting with it, but they're not going to become Babylonians. And that's a good witness to those that are there training with them. So 3 years go by, and the four men enter the king's service after those 3 years, and the king's really impressed. He likes these four more than all of the rest, and they're even wise 10 times, I don't know how you measure wisdom numerically, I don't know, but they're 10 times wiser than all the scholars, all the magicians throughout the empire. And it's not a surprise, because verse 17 clearly tells us why that is. It's because God gave them knowledge and understanding of what they were learning. They've learnt all about the culture through the gifts that God had given them, and so they impressed the king. As well as this, God's given Daniel this special ability to interpret dreams, which is not something he could have learned through learning, but that's definitely a gift from God. So, that's just a summary of the story. How is this relevant to us? As I've already said, I think Daniel's situation is quite similar to ours. We live in the world, but we're not supposed to be of it. We need to be different and we need to be distinctive. So there are four parts of the story that I think we can learn from. So the first is the fact that Daniel refused to eat the food. As I said, that's not necessarily because of law. It's not that God condemned him if he would eat the food, but there are other reasons. He needed to take a stand to work out how to be distinctive. And not eating the food is the way to do that. So there are certain things that the world might do that we definitely should not do because God specifically says it's wrong. There are commands in the Bible, commands from God, that we need to follow. But there are other things where perhaps there isn't a command from God, but where we as individuals are called to be different. Maybe that's because God's given you a very specific command, a calling, to stand out in a particular way. Or maybe not. So examples might be, some Christians choose not to drink alcohol. That's not something God says, never drink alcohol, but some Christians take a stand in that way. More modern, social media, the internet, the way we use that, that might be a place for some of us to take a stand, to do something different, not to like that slightly questionable photo, or even join that certain site. The way we speak, the words we choose, again, make us stand out as different. Not joining in with a particular thing, hobby, whatever it is that people invite you to join, saying no, taking a stand there. Not because it might break God's law, but because that's somewhere where you can stand up and make a difference. But let's turn it into a positive, because sometimes it's not that you don't do something the world does, it's that you do something that the world doesn't. So maybe you give, being generous with what you have, giving to a particular cause that others might not really be interested in. Making certain sacrifices, whatever they may be. Making friends with certain people that nobody else is really interested in. Taking a stand, being different. And people really do notice these things. It's often said that people notice what you do a lot more than they notice what you say. So you can shut up, listen to me, just watch me for the rest of the sermon. Don't. People see that you are not doing that thing that everyone else at work is doing, everyone else at school is doing. People notice that you are doing things that nobody else seems to be doing, and they think, that's a bit weird. How strange. And they might ask you about it, and you might get the chance to explain to them, but they might not ask, but it's still a really good witness. And often it takes a lot of courage to do that. It's very easy just to live as the world lives. And when it's not a specific command from God, you kind of excuse yourselves perhaps, that, well, God doesn't really mind if I do it. But if it's you've been told not to, then you don't do it. And Daniel didn't give in when the chief of staff said, no, I'm scared of the king. He found a way around it. And we need to make sure we're doing the same, that we're standing out, that we're being different in whatever way works for us, so that we can be a good witness. So that's the first lesson. I think the second lesson is about the fact that Daniel didn't refuse these other things that we talked about. He didn't object to the training program. Seems he didn't kick up a fuss about the change of name. And in fact, he used his God-given wisdom to know that he should embrace these things instead. It seems that he threw himself into the training program. He didn't refuse to enter the king's service after 3 years, although this was a Babylonian pagan culture. So we need wisdom again to choose our battles. We need to know, we need discernment to see where we need to take a stand and where we need to somehow interact with and embrace what's actually going on around us, because we have to live in the world. Jesus tells us, bad news folks, you've got to pay tax, for example. When asked whether tax should be paid, he got out the coin and he said, whose face is on this coin? And they said, it was Caesar's, the emperor's face, so give to the emperor what he deserves. And Paul tells us we should obey the law. Unless the law is conflicting with God's law directly, we should obey the law we're living in. We've got to work with the government, whether we like them or not. We need to work in the culture we're living in as well. We might not agree with all of the values and actions of the organisation you work for. You might have disagreements, but you need a job. And also you need to make a difference positively in the world. We often might have disagreements with family members who aren't Christians, but we're still family members with them, and we have to love them, we have to live with them, we have to function with them. We might have friends who aren't Christians who we have to function with as well. So we need to find out which areas of the secular world to engage with and to accept and have wisdom to know where we need to take a stand. I think a good way to try to work out maybe which is the right option is to remember that the chief commandments are to love God and to love our neighbours. When he was asked about which commandments are the greatest, Jesus answered by saying the most important one, the most important commandment is this: hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind, and with all your strength. And the second is this: love your neighbour as yourself. There are no commandments greater than these. Our calling as Christians is to do these two things: to love God with our all, and to love our neighbours as we love ourselves. So if you're faced with a particular situation, should I accept this part of the culture I'm in, or should I take a stand? Maybe that's something to think about. Which one shows more love to God? We need to serve Him with our all, which includes involvement in the world. We serve God with our jobs, when we're with our non-Christian friends. We serve God in the time we spend with non-Christian family members. We serve God by participating in good things that are done by non-Christians as well. We can show love to God by doing these things. And we can show love to others by not detaching yourself from the world, by working with the world. Love cannot work at arm's length. You can't say you love your neighbour and have nothing to do with them because they're not a Christian. That's not going to work. So we need to work out how to show love to God and to others in the best way. Clearly, if God has specifically said don't do something, then the way to show love to God is by obeying that command. But God also tells us to love each other, and if it's clear that engaging with a particular part of culture will show love to a person, then that's what we should do. And I think if we use those two commandments, that helps us make wise decisions about which battles to fight, how to work with the culture around us. So thirdly, specifically, Jesus embraced learning about a pagan culture. Now, I am familiar with the story, and so it doesn't come as much of a shock, but I think if you're not familiar with the story, you'd find verse 17 quite shocking, that God gave these men the ability to learn about a pagan culture, that they understood it so well because God helped them to. That sounds like a bit of a shock. But we shouldn't be surprised, because God wanted Daniel to make the most of the opportunity he had while he was there. Some of the things he learned, I am sure, conflicted with his faith, especially the astrology, would have conflicted with his faith. But he learned about it. That doesn't mean he believed it all, but he learned about it. And in fact, developing that knowledge of the culture of Babylon was why he was there. So if we're called to love God and to love each other, we need to discover our individual calling from God as well, as the calling we all have. And for Daniel, that was to pursue this academic learning of the Babylonian culture, so he could then go on to serve several kings, interpret dreams, and tell them the truth about God. Your calling is probably not going to be to study Babylonian culture for 3 years, although maybe that's what God is saying to you this morning, who knows? But whatever our calling is, we need to embrace that calling. Well, many of us spend most of our time predominantly in the secular world. And we need to embrace that job that we've got, to do what we can to make a difference. In fact, it might be that wherever you're called to serve God out there in the secular world, you might feel you're serving Him, you're closer to Him more there than in the religious world. I don't know whether any of you watch Grantchester. It's really odd. The premise is that this vicar who solves all these murders. Very strange. Anyway, one episode recently, he was there, and he runs his boxing club, and he was there at the ring during a fight, and he said that he felt closer to God then than he has done for weeks. So he spends most of his, well, I don't know, according to the program, he spends most of his time fighting crime, but I imagine he spends time preparing sermons, preaching, and so on. But he felt closer to God watching these men, young men, box. So perhaps it's something in the secular world where you feel you're serving God most, where you feel you're closest to God. And often in my job, I feel closest to God when I'm there at work. So actually, rejecting, detaching from the secular world is not what God wants from us. He wants us to use the gifts, use the opportunities that He's given us to serve Him where we are. The second lesson I think we can take from the embracing the pagan culture is really relevant to us, because we do live in a multicultural society. And around us there are a fascinating array of beliefs and ideas, different sorts of lifestyles, and lots of these completely conflict with what we believe. And so we shouldn't adopt them, but we should definitely embrace learning about them, like Daniel did. This is a quote from a commentary I read. "Intellectual development and true success can be achieved without spiritual compromise. The godly may master and employ the learning of the ungodly." You can still be a faithful Christian and learn about what other cultures, other beliefs have. And I think it's our duty to understand the world around us, including different religions, different ethical ideas, and so on. And the fact that God gave Daniel the gift to do that demonstrates that must be the case. And also, if we want to love our neighbours properly, we need to understand them as well as we can. We need to learn about what they believe and how they live to help us love them better. Fourth lesson from Daniel is that his impact was huge. He's a powerful witness during this training program, presumably to Jews and to non-Jews alike. And he quickly gains the favor of the chief of staff. And the fact that he is resilient through this restricted diet shows that he's standing up to be different and that that's had a good impact. He gets this gift of God to interpret Babylonian literature and to interpret dreams, and he really impresses the king. And he goes on to interpret the kings of the dreams of the king. It's like a film, isn't it? King of the Dreams. Anyway, he interprets the dreams of the king, and he teaches them about God. And I think all of this prepares him for what's going to happen later on. Next, he has to stand in even more difficult circumstances, and he refuses to stop praying to God and ends up in a lion's den. And of course, we've got a whole book here of the prophecies of Daniel that are here for us today. That impact started when he arrived in Babylon. He embraced his role, but he stood out as different. And balancing those two helped him make a big change in the world around him. You might feel small and insignificant, but you can have an enormous impact where you are, amongst your families and friends, in your workplaces, in the clubs or groups that you belong to, and so on. To function successfully where we are means that we need to decide which parts of the world to embrace and work with, and where we need to take a stand. And to do this, I think we need to keep God in view. So we've just sung, "Be Thou My Vision." And in that song, we talked about wisdom from God. We need to ask God to give us wisdom, to look to him, to find out how to love him and love others better. And we'll see how we should live. So you may have heard of the Serenity Prayer. I've rewritten it, which is probably illegal, but it. Who wrote it? Can't be copyrighted anymore. Anyway, so this is the Serenity Prayer. I'm going to read it to you to ponder, and then I'm going to pray, and the prayer is going to start with this. I've not given it a name. This prayer. So the prayer says, "God, give me the passion to embrace the things in the world I need to work with, the courage to refuse the things in the world I need to avoid, and the wisdom to know the difference." Let's pray. God, give us the passion to embrace the things in the world that we need to work with, the courage to refuse the things in the world we need to avoid, and the wisdom to know the difference. We thank you for the calling that you've given us all to love you and to love each other. We thank you for the individual callings you've given to us where we are. Help us to serve you wholeheartedly, to embrace the things that are in the world around us that we can work with, to know how we can make a difference, and to know when we need to take a stand, and to have courage like Daniel did, to say no when we know that that's what you want us to do. Fill us with your spirit, give us vision of you, so that we can have wisdom to know what we need to do in each situation, and how we need to live our lives. Amen.